This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire Republican Governor Chris Sununu is with us today, and there's lots to talk about. The governor released his budget just a few days ago with plenty to please both Republicans and Democrats. Also, Governor Sununu has made business attraction a key priority. Meanwhile, many employers worry about finding workers to fill the jobs they already have. And then there's health care, with debate at the state and national level about the future of the Affordable Care Act. We'll tackle these issues and more. Our conversation is part of NPR and NHPR's effort to look at the first 100 days of the White House and the State House. You can join us, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Governor Sununu, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you for shoveling yourself out. And did you make it in on a snowplow?
No, I shoveled in. I think like a lot of us, I was up around 5:30 shoveling out the remains of my driveway. I used to have an attachment on the front of my tractor, and that rusted out. So now I'm back to doing it by hand like most people are. So.
Well, it's good exercise. And Governor Sununu, I wanted to start right off the bat with something that happened over the weekend. More concerns about New Hampshire's elections system. This is a topic raised frequently by you and State House Republicans. And Governor, we've received tons of commentary from our listeners on this. So I'm going to let them actually start this segment of our conversation. Here's an email from Michael who says, Donald Trump has made repeated claims that he lost the popular vote due to voter fraud and gave New Hampshire as an example, stating that he and Kelly Ayotte lost New Hampshire because of thousands of illegal voters being bussed in from Massachusetts to vote. Top advisor Steve Miller concurred with this by saying, I've actually worked on a campaign in New Hampshire. This bussing voters into New Hampshire is widely known. Michael asks, do you, Governor Sununu, also agree with voter fraud in New Hampshire? And if so, what is the specific evidence that this has occurred? Michael asks, if not, will you go on the record and publicly state that this claim is not true? And Michael, thank you so much for contacting us.
Yeah, absolutely. Big topic of the weekend, without a doubt. Is there specific evidence of voter fraud that I know of? No, there's not. There's not. Do we need to strengthen our voter laws? Yes, there's no doubt about that. We have a lot of ambiguity in our voter laws. I think there's a lot of areas where we can strengthen and more clearly define the laws to make sure that it is a clean process, so to say. But I do hear the president's concerns. We have been reaching out to the administration and basically saying, look, if there's real evidence, then yes, let's keep that conversation going and let me understand what. Maybe they know something we don't. But is there clear evidence of voter fraud here? I don't know of any.
So you've reached out to the White House saying, give us evidence. Have you reached out to the White House saying, stop it, please? Because a lot of top Republicans, former party chairs, former national committeemen, people who've worked on many, many a Republican campaign are all saying, look, please, White House, just stop saying this.
I haven't said stop it yet, but I'm saying, what is this really based on, right? If there's information, if there's evidence there, then by all means, I think we all need to see it. But right now, we're not privy to anything.
What more evidence would they have, given that, again, all these party chairs, top party officials, Secretary of State's office, town officials up and down? I mean, what more evidence would the White House have that these people who are on the ground here in New Hampshire have that we don't have already?
I'm not sure, although it is the White House. I mean, and they were involved, as we were both involved, in a very significant elections the last time around. They had efforts across the state that even I didn't have. If there's something there, by all means, we're happy to look at it. But right now, we're just making sure that the laws that we have on the books are strengthened. We get rid of some of that ambiguity. We define what a resident is, what domiciled is, these kind of areas where I think we've left it very gray. But we'll strengthen that up and make sure that whatever we have going forward within the state of New Hampshire is something viable and clean.
Here's a comment on social media from Tricia who says, will you speak out against President Trump's disproven allegations of voter fraud in New Hampshire? At what point, Governor Sununu, do you stop saying, okay, tell us what you've got and start saying, look, just don't say this anymore. You're hurting.
Well, again, I think, you know, this conversation kind of was started up again just this past week. So we reached out over the weekend a little bit. We had the storm going here. We had a lot of other things happening in the state. But we did reach out again and just say, if there's something there, please let us know. But we'll take it step by step as we go forward.
If they show you something that you don't think is satisfactory, and most Republican officials in the state seem to think they will not present anything viable, then do you step out, Governor Sununu, and say, okay, President Trump, I supported you, but please don't impugn our elections.
Well, look, let's be clear. I very much support the president. There's no doubt about that. If it comes to bear that there really is nothing in terms of evidence, then, of course, we're going to be very, very upfront and forthright about that. We're here on the ground. We're here in the state of New Hampshire. We know our process. I've been in contact with the attorney general about this as well. And again, right now, we don't have any evidence that we know of. So if something else comes to bear, we'll deal with it when it comes up.
Another person wrote in on social media, says, please present evidence proving your allegation that the state's Democratic Party registered Massachusetts residents to vote illegally in New Hampshire. This was a comment you made back around the election about on the Howie Carr show.
Yeah, around the election.
Why they quoted.
No, around the election, I did use the term that they were being bussed in. And look, the fact of the matter is we have folks that come into this state, whether they're working on campaigns or they come in very temporarily and can register to vote. It is actually legal to do that. So, again, it's not technically fraud. I understand that. I think that's when maybe we misuse the word fraud or other folks misuse the word fraud. It isn't fraud because our laws are very loose and do allow it. Do I think it's fair? No, I don't. Are they real residents of the state? No, they are not. The fact that we had multiple people, students and campaign workers, that were actually domiciled and claimed residency at a state one of our former state senators' homes, that gives me pause for concern. So, you know, if they're true residents here, then by all means, they have to have that be afforded that right to vote. If they're just coming over here on a very temporary basis to vote in our elections and then go home across back over state lines, well, no, nobody wants that. So it's just about really cleaning up that process and understanding what it is. Is it fraud? It is not. Unfortunately, our laws do allow that. And that's just looking where we're trying to strengthen the law.
The student issue has gone back and forth over the years in New Hampshire, and we'll set that aside for now. Some people say they should be allowed to vote because they're here for a long time. Others say no. They should vote at home.
Students should definitely be allowed to vote. There's no question about that.
You mentioned campaign workers, though, signing up to vote in New Hampshire. Is there evidence that happened, that somebody came in for a month to work on a campaign?
Yeah. I mean, it's legal. Don't get me wrong. If they're here temporarily working on a campaign, they can walk in and if they can claim that they are a current resident of the state, because there's no, again, what is a resident? That's a very loose term. They can walk in, same day voter registration, and cast a vote. And then literally the next day, leave the state. That's legal in our process. That's where I think most people would agree. We probably just need to tighten it up.
When I registered to vote, I had to show an electric bill. Mm-hmm. I had to show, I can't remember, some other piece of documentation.
Easy.
So
yeah.
How would a campaign worker from Massachusetts have that electric bill or that?
Well, if you come over here and you're living in an apartment for a week or two and you have an electric bill, you know, if you can have you can be renting an apartment and be able to show a residency very, very easily here. We literally accept not just 10, but almost, I think, close to 100 different types of identification in terms of what is a resident. And again, just showing an electric bill is a very simple thing. It might only be that you've lived here a week or two, but if you show that, then you're okay.
So how would you like to change this system, Governor Sununu? I know there's been a lot of talk about this in the legislature mm-hmm. as well. What specific changes would you like to make?
Well, I think we're looking at things like, what is a resident, right? What does domiciled mean? Because you have to look at what the current law is on the books. Tightening those definitions up. So there's a few other things. And also making sure that if there are cases where the voting registration is being abused, and we actually have an attorney general and a process that follows up that actually will you know, look at these cases and pursue them. We haven't pursued a significant case of voter fraud in the state in years. Now, again, a part of it is because, you know, the law is so loose, it's really hard to go after those folks, so to say, and to prove anything, because we have a very loose system here. We have the first in the nation primary. We have a huge responsibility. We have massive voter turnout in the state. Those are all very, very good things. If there's ever anywhere in the country where we need true integrity in our system and we need to ensure that, it's right here in New Hampshire.
We got a lot of questions from our listeners, too, about your support for getting rid of same-day voter registration. Looks like that's not going to happen now, Governor Sununu. It looks like we're going to stick with this system for now. What was was your issue with same-day voter registration?
Well, it's just what we talked about. Anybody can really walk through the door, sign an affidavit, show an electric bill, and you're good to go. Does that truly mean that they're a resident of the state? To go away from same-day voter registration means we'd have to go into what they call motor voter. Motor voter is really defined by federal law. Likely would not be something that we would do here in the state. When you look at the details of it, you have provisional ballots that come into play and all these other technical things. So probably not what we want to do in the state. My guess is that same-day voter registration will remain here, which is fine. Again, as long as we just make sure we're defining what is domiciled and what is a resident. That's all.
Again, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Governor Sununu, I want to ask about your efforts to attract businesses to the state, a big priority. I can't remember the exact name of your initiative, 100 businesses in 100 days.
Okay. Yeah, it's great.
However, the big complaint that I hear from economists and business leaders time and time again is, you know, never mind the jobs, we need workers to fill the jobs already here. So what specific ideas do you have in mind to address this part of the equation?
Sure. So, you know, something, and because the budget came up this past week, so let's jump into that a little bit. One thing that we did is we really looked at when we're looking at, like, for example, healthcare workers, right? We pay our healthcare workers in this state rock bottom sums. We really do. The examples I used, and we pulled up some data, we pay toll booth collectors more than nursing attendants. We pay people more to wash your car than we pay to wash and care for our elderly and our loved ones. So we've created a program out of what I call the Infrastructure Revitalization Fund that will be created at the end of this fiscal year as we enter into June. We've put $5 million aside strictly for raising the wages and addressing the wage disparity problem that we have currently between New Hampshire and other states, whether it be Boston or New York, where a lot of our healthcare workers are going, to really address this issue. So we have to get serious about it. The term I use a lot is markets matter. Right. If the market is dictating that someone can get a significantly higher wage south of the border doing the exact same job, then chances are they're going to go there. So things like that are how we have to kind of incentivize our workforce here. I've also created a program that increases the debt assistance. So in other words, when you come out of one of our schools, if you stay and work in one of these high need areas, we'll help you pay down your debt. Right. Let's incentivize that workforce to be here. And at the same time, we still have to go after jobs. We still have to go after these new businesses. We have incredible opportunities to drive exciting new high-paying jobs into this state. We can't sit back. I think we've sat back on our heels for the past few years. That's not the role of the governor. The role of the governor is to be forceful about it, to be aggressive about it. We've already had numerous companies in here. Doing 100 businesses in 100 days is not going to be difficult. We have something like 150 lined up at this point. They're really knocking on the door. They're dying to come in. They love what we're talking about. They love that we're being pro-business, breaking down regulations, lowering business taxes, dealing with the things that really encumber their ability to do what they do best. But we're going to break all that down and really open the doors and finally say we're open for business.
Can you tell them that they'll find the skilled workers that they need right here? Again, that is the complaint I just hear time and time again.
Oh, there's no doubt we have the workers here. We're just not retaining them, right? So much of our workforce after they graduate high school or college or community college, whatever it is, picks up and walks south of here. So to the point you brought up earlier, we need to incentivize them to stay. And when you look at the programs that we have here, educating and creating that skilled workforce, they're tremendous. They really are second to none. And that's what gets some of these businesses very excited. We have a very hard, very productive workforce. For example, if you go over to SIG, I was at the SIG Arms recently. They have plants all over the world. And the CEO was telling me how the productivity in Portsmouth far exceeds any of his plants around the world, right? He's got a great workforce. They're excited to come to work. Their productivity is so high. But we have to, and part of that is because we generate programs that create the skill sets and train exactly to the needs of that business. And then we can do that all over the state, again, with whether it's through our high schools, our career schools, our community colleges, the university system. We have this infrastructure, which is wonderful, but it's kind of pent up potential, if you will. And we just need to release that potential, drive the workforce back in here, retain them, and drive business in here to, again, put all those pieces together.
The pot of money that you talked about, Governor Sununu, to increase the wages of healthcare workers, again, that you mentioned, you know, eloquently in your budget. who does that go to? Does that go to, you know, public nursing home nurses? Does it go to, you know, private nurses
it's,
at Concord Hospital?
Really,
I mean,
it's really on the public side. On the private side, we're doing okay. But
in terms
of
wages.
See, the private side will always stay about two steps ahead of the public side, right? Because that's all they have to. That's the competition. So if as we raise the wages to an appropriate level on the public side, the private side goes up as well. It's kind of 1 + 1 = 3, right? You do a couple things here and there, but the returns can be just tremendous. If you put your emphasis on it, you focus on it, realize what the problem is, and put real solutions.
Lots of people want to join our conversation, Governor Sununu. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And to the callers, Governor Sununu, Allison joins us from Campton. Hi, Allison. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, this is so exciting. I've been listening to your show for years.
Good.
So you were talking about voter fraud and people from out of state registering and voting in New Hampshire. Laura, you asked Governor Sununu for evidence, for proof, cases where people have actually done this, like campaign workers have registered and voted in New Hampshire when they've only been living here for a week or two. So two things. One is I have had to change my electric bill when I moved, and it's not a process that you just whip off in a week or two. You need to change your address. It takes some time, and you need to have an electric bill with your name on it. So I really can't believe that anybody would be able to do that in a week or two and would go to that effort just to fraudulently vote. Second, Laura, you did ask him for proof and for cases, and I'd really like to hear him pressed harder to provide that. Governor, you say, oh, sure, but that I'm sick of hearing alternative facts. I want some proof.
Okay, Allison, so. Thank you for calling.
Well, again, let's be clear. I'm not saying there's voter fraud in the state of New Hampshire. Let's be very clear about that. We bring up the electric bill as an example, but there's literally hundreds of ways to show that you're a resident here. There are when they ask you for an ID, for example, I think there's something like 87 different IDs, or it might even be more, that you can show to show that you are who you are. So we have just a very flexible system here, which, you know, has its positives to be sure, but you have to understand that it's also ripe for fraud. Fraud's not the right word. Ripe for abuse. Right? That's the different word we should use. It gets abused a little bit. There's no doubt about it.
But do we know? Like, do you have an example of Susie Smith from, you know, Boston, Massachusetts, came up here? And
look at the example that came up a few years ago when you had, it was 4, 5, or 6 campaign staffers that claimed residency at a state senator's home, Martha Fuller Clark's home. I mean, that's a documented case. Now, it was legal. They could do that. But they weren't really from here. They were campaign workers that were bunking at her house. It is part of our process, I understand, but I think most people would agree that's not right. And again, you just have to have better integrity in the system, especially if we're going to be the first in the nation primary.
Allison, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Governor Sununu, back to our conversation about workforce development. Your budget did increase the community college system budget, but no increase for the university system. How come the difference?
Well, the community—it's— You know, we have a tradition here, and I think we have to be a little more give a little more forethought to the thinking. We think of post-secondary education in terms of the institutions. The community college gets this, and the university system gets that, and our career schools will get this. We need to think more encompassing. We need to think about what the flexibility that we need to provide our workforce to create the best path for themselves. So in the case of the community college system, there are some dynamics there where they're having some tremendous outcomes. Not to say the university system is not, but those are two very different dynamics. The amount of money that the state puts into the community college system has a much, much bigger effect on the operational effectiveness of that system than the university system does because it's such a much larger system. I want to say, I think what the state puts into the university system accounts for about 8 or 9% of the operational budget there. On the community college side, it's a much, much higher percentage.
So it has a bigger impact.
It has a much bigger impact, and you have to look at the outcomes and what you're getting. So again, it's in terms of the dynamics at the community college system, it really made sense. They have some great programs. They're trying to strengthen that system. The university system is much more robust. We've made some great investments over there. We're going to keep moving forward. We have a scholarship program that we're investing millions of dollars into, again, to incentivize kids into the path of their choice. It's really about flexibility in the workforce and making sure that our citizens can design their path forward.
Lots more to talk about in just a moment. Stay with us for more conversation with New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I'm Virginia Prescott on the latest episode of the Civics 101 podcast. The Constitution clearly allows for amendments, but is a little vague on how to do it.
The Constitution actually says only in very terse terms how it expects this to work. And so whole questions like time limits, do they have to have the process finished within a certain period of time, are not really addressed.
Subscribe to Civics 101 and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or wherever you download yours.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Governor Chris Sununu, in his second month in office, talks with us about his budget and his priorities. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Governor Sununu, just before the break, we were talking about workforce development. Again, the number one concern we hear from economists and business leaders is there's just not enough great workers to fill the jobs already here. You talked about your decision to increase the community college system budget, but not the university system. Here's what Chancellor Todd Leach said. He said, keeping our public four-year colleges and universities affordable is not only critical for hardworking New Hampshire families, but also for the many businesses that depend on highly skilled talent to grow, thrive, and succeed. So Chancellor Leach, Governor Sununu, seems to be saying you're on the wrong track in terms of workforce development, that this, you know, clearly wasn't the choice that he feels New Hampshire needs.
Oh, I think we're on more than the right track. So contrary to what the university system wanted to do, as they were looking, for example, a scholarship to take care of 46 or 50 of our valedictorians of the state. Well, that sounds great. So they could go to the university system. My approach is very different. I'm putting $5 million into a fund that a minimum of 1,000 students every year can now participate in, not just for the university system, but the community college or the university system or professional schools or whatever it might be.
Whatever, in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire. Whatever path they deem best for them to get the skills they need to enter the workforce, that's the flexibility we're now providing. It's we've never done it before. But this is the way to go in the 21st century. I understand the university system wants the money. They want to drive all the students just to the university system. And university system does a great job. There's no doubt. But it's not the path for everyone. And we need to recognize that and create programs that really can fit everybody's needs.
They seem to hint after the budget that they would now not be able to freeze tuition.
That might be, but again, that's their budgetary, you know, that's them operating their budget. We don't control their budget that way.
Okay, let's take another call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Evie is in Concord. Hi, Evie. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi. My concern with the governor's problem of attracting people to come and live in this state resides around the point that we have a horribly miserable, unfair property tax. I have a humble three-bedroom home, and I pay over $600 a month property taxes. That is not attractive to anyone thinking of coming here.
Evie, thank you so much. Oh, go ahead, Evie.
I was just going to say, I'm waiting for someone in the Republican Party about this, you know, millions of unfair votes, to say the emperor really has no clothes.
Okay. Evie, thank you so much.
So she brings up a great point. We have high property taxes in the state. There's no doubt about it. The state cannot just artificially lower property taxes. It doesn't work that way. It's about local control. But what the state can do is provide some resources to provide more financial flexibility to individuals in their towns. So traditionally, for example, we put out about $30 million or so in what we call betterment funds, infrastructure funds, to all the towns and municipalities. It's very fair. It's based on population. And we hand the check to those municipalities. In my budget this year, I'm proposing to double that. Roads, bridges, schools, right? When you can provide the locals a big check to give them more financial flexibility to take care of their projects there, that gives them the opportunity to then say, okay, what can we do on our property tax level? You're looking at a state with high healthcare costs, incredibly high energy costs. We have a lot of folks on fixed incomes. We have an elderly population here that really has a hard time dealing with the high property taxes. So instead of the state, I think we're traditionally at the state level, we say, well, there's nothing we can do about that. I'm taking a much more aggressive approach. I say we double, at least double the money that goes to those individuals individual communities, provide that financial relief. And again, that will give us some more time and some more ability, I think, to create our own path within those communities and keep those property taxes where they need to be.
Let's talk about healthcare Governor Sununu. And we received a lot of questions on social media from our listeners about the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion. Michelle wrote in, she says, low-income New Hampshire adults and communities benefit greatly from Medicaid expansion. Healthy adults, healthy economy. Michelle says, will you continue Medicaid expansion? Thank you, Michelle, for the question.
Yeah, so Medicaid expansion doesn't come up as part of the state budget process. There are no state taxes involved in Medicaid expansion. I believe it's set to come up next year in the next biennium. In 2018 is when it is set to expire. So the legislature will take it up next February or March, April, something like that. And we'll kind of debate out, you know, where we want to go from there. The big issue with Medicaid expansion right now is, what's Washington going to do? We don't know. We really don't. I'm hearing a lot out of Washington that they're looking at block grants, which would be wonderful. It's essentially the money that comes to the state without all the bells, whistles, and mandates that aren't necessarily in our interest. So depending on where Washington goes, I think will dictate a lot of our ability to maintain the Medicaid expansion program. I think it's had great results for our people. There's no doubt about that. As the costs increase, we have to make sure that whatever we do doesn't increase. We don't carry that cost burden to our taxpayers. But that'll all be part of the equation that we look at next year.
So for now, just setting it aside until 2018?
Yeah, I mean, that's, yes.
That's the law.
Yeah, that's the law. Yeah.
You know, in terms of block grants, the criticism is that these are inflexible in terms of meeting new needs, whether there's a sudden increase in the number of people needing the program because of an economic situation or there's a new illness. We spoke to a longtime health policy attorney just last week who said, you know, don't kid yourself. Block grants always mean less money for people who need the program because there's the block. You know, it doesn't change even if the need in the state suddenly changes.
Right. So we don't know what if it comes in block grants, what the amount will be necessarily. That'll be a big factor that we have to look at. There is no doubt that we have to spend tens of millions of dollars that we receive from the federal government on things that are not in our interest, that we don't need.
Such as?
Let's look at what we do need. When we look at, we have a more elderly population than most. Not a negative thing, but a dynamic we have to address. We have a substance abuse crisis here that other states don't have. Things that we do need to address. That's where our focus and our monies need to go. Right now, the way the federal government does, it's a one-size-fits-all out of Washington, D.C. And what happens is the state has to constantly apply for these waivers that they're onerous, they're cumbersome, and sometimes we get them and sometimes we don't. So by breaking down that process of not having to constantly apply for waivers, constantly apply for exemptions, maybe you get them, maybe you don't, and just giving us the ability to design the system that best meets our needs, that's always going to be a better solution.
So it's more flexible in terms of policy, but in terms of people, Governor Sununu, the criticism is, again, if more people suddenly get on the rolls,
sure,
the block grant is not going to accommodate those people.
Yeah.
That's
the
concern.
Are more people going to jump onto the Medicaid rolls? I have to be honest, I don't think so. And I'm basing that on what we've been in communication, obviously, with our own health and human services. We know our demographics. I don't think we're going to see a surge in population onto the Medicaid rolls. But we do have a lot of folks on there now. They have real needs, and we have to make sure we're addressing them.
We did a program. We've done dozens of programs on this Medicaid expansion. But I do remember we brought in several Republicans to talk about this. And one of the most passionate supporters of the Medicaid expansion was State Senator Jeb Bradley, who I know leader in the state Senate, and an architect of this bipartisan approach. He really feels like this program has helped New Hampshire a lot.
He's right. There's no doubt.
In terms of substance abuse, in terms of making workers healthy, the Business and Industry Association supported Medicaid expansion. Do you think it's been helpful, Governor Sununu?
Without a doubt. There's no doubt it's been helpful. It has a price tag of somewhere between $400 and $500 million. We've been able to do it to date without a single New Hampshire taxpayer dollar. No state taxes go into it, which is great. The difference of what the federal government pays and what we would otherwise pay is right now being made up by the private sector. That's wonderful. As that number goes up, will the private sector still be there and still be willing to keep paying that bill? I hope so, but we don't know. Again, this is going to be part of the debate as we enter next year to find out what the dynamics are. Is the federal government, what is the block grant going to be? Is it going to be as much as it is now, 90%, 80%? Will that meet our needs? All these pieces of the puzzle are really going to come together, I think, over the next 6 to 9 months. And we're going to have a good, healthy debate about the next steps forward, sometime in early 2018.
Many Republicans on Capitol Hill and even the president recently have seemed to have gone from repeal and replace That was the mantra during the election, to let's take our time, tap on the brakes, retain pieces.
You need a runway. Everyone's using that term. You need a runway. Well, you do. Look, you have so many people on the system. You can't just send a shockwave into the system and expect there not to be negative outcomes. I think we had that when the ACA first came into being. Remember, we had this literally 1,000-page bill or whatever, and we had to pass it before we can understand what's in it, you know, that kind of nonsense you hear out of Washington. So again, I think what we're saying now is let's understand what we're going to do before we do it, right? Let's read our bill and write the bill, make sure everyone in Congress knows what the impacts are before we just dump into something too quickly that can just have negative impacts to everybody. So I think it's a smart approach. They keep using that term, we're going to build the runway before we take off. That's always a smart thing.
Let's take another call. This is Norma in Nashua. Hi, Norma. You're on the air with Governor Sununu. Go ahead.
Hi. So New Hampshire has failed our most vulnerable citizens with mental health challenges for more than a decade. The managed care organizations were supposed to be the cure-all, and the crisis has not only continued, but it has worsened. So who in your administration will be responsible to implement the 10-year plan and make the improvements called for in the federal class action lawsuit, and how will they do it?
Sure, Norma, and that's been ongoing. New Hampshire has been, she's right, slipping behind this mandated by the courts, by the way, plan to improve our mental health system. Thank you for the call, Norma.
Yeah, I talked about it as the next unspoken crisis. She is absolutely right. We have a real crisis when you look at what goes on and what the roles and responsibilities are between our local mental health agencies, the state, the managed care organizations. We haven't fully implemented long-term assistance in mental health with our managed care organizations. We've kind of done it halfway, if you will. So it's a broken system that we just haven't gotten our hands dirty to say, how do we fix it? I spoke with Ken Norton. He's the head of NAMI, who oversees a lot of the mental health agencies and the interests of those fighting mental health. And look, it's nothing that goes away. It's a lifelong issue that constantly has to be cared for, right? Some of our most vulnerable citizens. We saw what happened at New Hampshire Hospital. Folks know that I wasn't too happy with Dartmouth-Hitchcock, the transfer of that contract, handling some of those issues. So what I said to Ken is, come in. Let's all sit down. We're going to put everybody in the room together and find out where we can agree and get something done. But she is absolutely right. The state has really, over the past 3 or 4 years, fallen flat in terms of their responsibility of handling those with mental health issues.
So what do you do that's different, Governor Sununu, given budget constraints, given that there are other big concerns on the horizon, you know, DCYF, the opioid crisis? I mean, there is this plan that is supposed to be put out, you know, and every mm-hmm. 6 months, the overseer says, here's how you do in New Hampshire. And by the way, you're kind of behind. I mean, what do you do that's different to kind of yank this forward?
And I'm not here to bash on previous administrations, but you take the bull by the horns, you get everyone in the room, and you do your job. You manage it. And you don't just put things aside because you're in an election season. You don't put data away until after the election happens to find out what the realities are. You put everything on the table and you be transparent. That's kind of the tone that I think we really need to hit the reset button with. I know we just came off of a very ugly year in 2016. A lot of attacks. You see all the personal attacks. And I was not immune from it. I got to tell you, it was brutal. It was really brutal. But one of my key jobs, if you will, my roles as governor, is to set a positive tone, to be transparent, to put politics aside. I'm a big believer if we do our job as elected officials, the votes will come. Don't worry about the election. Don't worry about the politics. I emphasize that to both my Republican and Democrat folks in the legislature, folks across both state and local government. If we focus and we're honest with ourselves and we're honest with our people, the election will take care of itself. You really need to take care of some of these issues. These are real crises that have just been kicked. The can has been kicked the can down the road just too long. And she's absolutely right. We got to address it. We did put some new money, about $3 million, to directly affect and help some of the folks with mental health issues. Our ACT teams raising what we pay for those teams, those healthcare workers. Again, that'll all help make us more competitive and not lose quality workers south of the border. You know, you brought up DCYF, another huge issue, Division of Children, Youth, and Families. We have a crisis over there, and it's all of our faults. Everybody has to take responsibility. But again, I'm not going to let that can get kicked down the road any longer. We're putting real money into there. We're going to address the staffing levels, address the statutorial inequities we have in the system. At the end of the day, it's just all about those kids. We have kids in very tough situations, abusive homes, abusive situations. The fact, if we're not doing 110% of our job to take care of that immediately, then we're failing. And I'm just not going to let it happen.
Well, you did say in your budget address, I do not see this as a choice, but a moral obligation. You said we need, I'm quoting you here, a new approach to the way we protect our most vulnerable children. And I just wonder what that new approach looks like, Governor Sununu.
Priority. Making them a true priority, not a line item in the budget. And I think they've been a line item in the budget for too long. So putting it to the forefront, talking about it openly, breaking down the political barriers. You know, I went in and spoke to some of these, our caseworkers at DCYF on the very ground level, not the management. It's always best to walk in the front door and just start talking to people. What's going on there? You know, I think it's getting better, but there's no doubt a couple months ago, morale was very low. The caseloads were incredibly high. These folks didn't have time to get out into the field to see these kids, to talk about their cases that they thought were severe were getting thrown out at the court level, not because the courts are doing anything wrong, but because statutorily there's an inequity there. The way we assess things is not the same way the court is assessing and defining the law. So we got to, again, make those things match together legislatively. By putting all of this on the table, making it a forefront priority, not letting politics get in the way, I really feel that we are going to see a significant positive change and, again, just get better outcomes for those kids.
And I hate to sound like a broken record, but all these things you're talking about, you know, DCYF, mental illness, opioid crisis,
the DD
aging
community.
Population. Yeah. I mean, the developmental disabilities community, very happy with the increase in budget that you gave
sure.
them.
$57 million. Dollars,
yeah. I just keep thinking about where these caring workers are going to come from. I just can't emphasize enough how many times people have said to me, we've got, you know, 30 vacancies, 80 vacancies, 100 vacancies. I just don't know where they're going to come from, these folks.
Well, they're out there. They're out there. Again, we're not competitive. We haven't been competitive for so long. We need a whole change in attitude. They're in Boston. They're in New York. They're in our systems now, and these kids are already applying for jobs out of state. When we create these incentive programs, we can retain them here. When we're looking to, whether it's paying down their debt or raising their wages, whatever it might be, it's not going to happen overnight. You're absolutely right, Laura. It's going to take some time. But you know, we got to start. We can't just ignore the problem anymore. And again, working with the private sector, finding out where hospitals can come more into play, working with the nonprofits, addressing what we can on the public side. When you put all these pieces of the puzzle on the table, you're transparent about it, and you promote all the good things we're doing to drive business and drive a strong economy here, we're really going to stand out, and not just amongst New England, but I think amongst the entire Northeast Corridor as a place to come, you know, raise your family, be part of our workforce, be part of our great quality of life here. You know, for some folks who maybe aren't used to shoveling in the Southern Tier, we'll drive them up too.
Okay. Let's take another call. This is Kieran. I hope I'm pronouncing it right, in Concord. Go ahead, Kieran.
Thank you, Laura. My question, you know, we know that children who are victims of sexual abuse and who have witnessed domestic violence are far more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol, to struggle with chronic health problems and mental illness, to end up incarcerated, and sometimes to become victims or abusers themselves. Your budget, Governor Sununu, spends millions of dollars on the effects of domestic and sexual violence, yet it cuts funding for domestic violence crisis centers and appropriates zero general fund dollars for sexual assault intervention and prevention. Wouldn't it make more sense to invest in programs that assist victims rather than to pay for the very costly effects of domestic and sexual violence later in life?
Kieran, thank you for the call.
Not a bad point at all. But again, our focus right now is dealing with the crises that we have within our system. You know, one thing we did for the first time ever, we put $250,000 into the Internet Predator Program here. So we are actually putting state funds for the first time to address the predators. You know, one thing that I don't think people realize is when we have all this, the kids have all these access to the internet, to phones, to all this, they're really walking around with computers full time in their pockets at this point. And the predatory issues we have over the internet with cybercrime, not cybercrime, but over the internet with children right now is at an all-time high. We only have three or four groups throughout the state that currently monitor those activities. Concord, Manchester, Portsmouth has a small group. And for the first time, we're putting real money into those programs. You know, when I think what she's looking at is the term isn't recovery, but folks that have been victims of and trying to get them the help they need within their communities. There's no doubt that has to be addressed as well. I mean, my focus right now is making sure that we can fix the system and make sure that we're kind of limiting it on the prevention side.
Kieran, thanks for that call. And coming up, we'll talk about immigration, the role of foreign workers in New Hampshire's economy. Also, Governor Sununu, we got a lot of comments from our listeners about your choice of Frank Edelblue as education commissioner. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Virginia Prescott on the latest episode of the Civics 101 podcast. The Constitution clearly allows for amendments, but is a little vague on how to do it.
The Constitution actually says only in very terse terms how it expects this to work. And so whole questions like time limits, do they have to have the process finished within a certain period of time, are not really addressed.
Subscribe to Civics 101 and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or wherever you download yours.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu is with us today. It's part of NPR and NHPR's effort to look at the first 100 days of the White House and the State House. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Governor Sununu, the theme that keeps coming up this whole hour is, you know, all these things that you feel New Hampshire needs to do, going to be an effort to find the workers to fill these critical positions. I want to ask you about the role of foreign-born workers here in the state. Research from UNH showed that without foreign immigration, New Hampshire would have had more people leaving the state than moving in over a recent five-year period, that foreign immigration is really the only reason our population increased that little bit that it did. Also, that 40% of these foreign-born residents are highly educated, amounting for a disproportionate percentage of residents with graduate or professional degrees, you know, filling positions like doctors and nurses and dentists and so forth. What's your role, Governor Sununu, on the role, the part that these foreign workers are playing in building this workforce that we need, especially when it comes to healthcare?
Oh, I mean, the data's there. I think they're absolutely right. Foreign-born workers that come into our state have been a huge part of our success in terms of maintaining a vital and vibrant economy here. There's still more we can do, without a doubt. But, yeah, we just need to keep promoting it. And I think as we promote ourselves as a state, we become a better destination to bring in some of these, whether they're our domestic folks or foreign workers. You know, you always need to make sure you're going through. I think this really leads into the immigration issue, right? Obviously. And like I've always said, we need a strong vetting process. There's no doubt about it. We need to make sure that the federal government, whatever they're doing on their end, and we don't know a whole lot. They don't tell us very much at the state level when they send refugees or whatever it is. For me, it's all about just give us the information, you know, send us the refugees, of course, but give us the information. How are they being vetted? What's the process we're going through? There's kind of a black box down there in Washington, D.C. that we just don't have a lot of information out of. So we can be a real destination for foreign-born workers, international trade. I met with the consulate general from Israel. I met with some folks from Mexico, met with some folks from Canada, all looking for opportunities to increase trade with New Hampshire, bring businesses right here, not just into the United States, but into New Hampshire. We have to take advantage of all those opportunities.
Canada, for example, has been taking advantage recently of President Trump's immigration order, telling companies that, hey, we won't hinder your efforts to bring the best workers in from around the world, telling tech companies, hey, look to Canada to expand, not the U.S. A lot of high tech companies, Governor Sununu, you know this, are very upset with this immigration order. Other companies, too, though, not just the Silicon Valley folks, you know, Ford, Coca-Cola, business leaders here in New Hampshire have said this is a bad idea. You ran as a businessman, Governor Sununu. Was this a poor business decision by President Trump to put forth this immigration order?
Well, you know, as an incoming
governor—
From
a marketing perspective, a business perspective, what do you think?
From the marketing and PR perspective, could it have been rolled out a little better? Sure. I mean, you have to remember, no matter what President Trump does right now, it's going to be seen with a lot of antagonism, right? I mean, a lot of pushback. I mean, that's just the way, unfortunately, our country is right now. We're so divided.
Why do you think we are? Well, I know I'm changing the subject here for a second,
cycle.
But
it's the election cycle. It's you know, someone I made a joke once. I blame social media for all the world's troubles. but in some ways, because we just have such a different dynamic of how we communicate. I mean, I don't want to get too philosophical, but because of this new way we communicate, we're still in its infancy, right? With how we use the internet, how we use with social media, what the power of our voice is, and what the power of other folks' voices are. I think that's one thing that's kind of driving us apart as a country. I'm trying to set a whole new tone here. I really am. I have no tolerance. I have no patience for it, frankly. In New Hampshire, we do things differently. We do things better. It's the role of the governor to set that positive tone, to not be divided, and frankly, of all of our elected officials. President Trump is our president. I support him. I think everyone needs to support him. Now, I will say, as an incoming governor, he's an incoming president. One of the first things you want to do is kind of get a sense of your surroundings. How do the systems work? I mean, I know pretty well how things work here in New Hampshire. My guess is President Trump walked into Washington and said, okay, how are we doing it here, right? What is our vetting process? How do we deal with homeland security issues? How are we dealing with our environment? How are we dealing with these? So I put a 90-day moratorium on rules and regulations in the state just to say, what's going on? Why do we have certain things? A little checks and balance. He tried to do the same thing with the immigration rollout. I don't think it was received very well. And again, maybe the timing was a little tough. But again, I support any chief executive that has to make tough decisions to simply say, what is the process? Let's take a pause, understand our process before we make any big jumps and leaps going forward.
Does this immigration order and the upset about it hurt America's ability, New Hampshire's ability to attract the best and the brightest?
In the long run, I don't think so. I don't think so. Again, I'm not. Again, we're going to abide by the order, of course. I think the order is in the courts right now, so we're not even sure where it's going to end up. I'm really focused on New Hampshire. I'm focused on making sure New Hampshire is competitive, making sure that states like Massachusetts and other states like that aren't taking our workers, aren't taking our businesses. We're going to go from kind of the back of the pack to the front of the pack in terms of what we can do in terms of driving our economy, driving business, driving a vibrant workforce. That's my role and that's my focus.
All right, let's take some more calls. And in Lyme, Lee is on the air. Hi, Lee. Go ahead. You're on the air with Governor Sununu.
Given that approximately 59,000 children living in New Hampshire have special health needs and 28,800 have disabilities, you have a proposal to increase funding for charter schools. Will charter schools and all schools that receive public funding be held equally accountable to provide equal access to students with disabilities and special health needs? And will they need to meet the requirements of IDEA and Section 504? Is funding for special education for students attending charter schools built into your state budget? And since the current statutes place full responsibility for provision of special ed services for charter school students on the district of residence, while simultaneously diverting state funding from these districts, how do you propose to implement the expansion of charter schools without increasing the burden of cost of education on local towns?
Lee, thank you so much for calling. Longstanding concerns, Governor Sununu, I'm sure you're familiar with them, about charter schools. First of all, that they, this is the accusation, I'm not making it personally, that they are not held to the same standards as public schools when it comes to providing services for children with disabilities. So they sort of get off easy in that score.
Well, you have to understand, this is the 21st century. If we want to keep running our school system like it's 1970, I guess some folks want to do that. I don't. I believe in school choice. And by school choice, it isn't just public school versus charter or public versus private or homeschool or whatever it might be. It's really opening the doors. Again, it goes back to kind of the workforce we talked about. In the 21st century, it's about designing systems that have flexibility and pathways for everybody. The pathway for myself and my children might be very different than the pathway from you and your kids, and that's fine. Public schools are the backbone of our school system. There's no doubt about it. And charter schools are a part of that. Please remember, I'm the first governor in about 25 years that actually grew up in the New Hampshire public schools. I understand how great they are. My kids went to public schools here. So, it isn't an anti-public school thing, anything like that. When you strengthen what charter schools can do, I mean, you have to remember, charter schools get a fraction of the dollars that traditional public schools have. Charter schools have many more of the costs that traditional public schools have. There's a dynamic there. Right now, she brought the example that our traditional public schools in our communities really handle most of the special education and some of the special programming in our communities that charter schools cannot handle. Well, again, charter schools only take a fraction of the dollars, but traditional public schools get more of the dollars right now. The $15 million I've proposed to strengthen the charter schools just tries to get them even a little closer to parity. They're not even close yet, though. So, when you go into some of these facilities, we have great teachers with great programs in some very tough conditions with great outcomes, right? We need to promote that, and we need to provide that flexibility. The other issue I want to bring up when we talk about school choice, people don't understand. School choice is also the choices and the pathways we're providing for our students currently in our traditional public schools.
So it isn't just either or, private, charter.
No, not at all.
It's not so much about the building.
Right. So, for example, I want a 6th or 7th or 8th grader in our public schools to be able to start designing the pathway that best fits their needs within that school system. So I'm a big proponent of allowing kids to potentially test out of subjects they're already proficient in so they can spend more time in areas where they want to excel their kind of early onset career path. I think that's a great opportunity there. Give teachers more flexibility to do what they do best, right? I don't mind standards. I don't like Common Core. That's no secret, because it puts so much pressure within those classrooms. These teachers don't have time to challenge kids who could be challenged or provide more assistance to those who might need more assistance. That, to me, is as a part of school choice, allowing the teachers to make better choices for their students. It's really an all-encompassing concept that we just, again, we have the foundation for here in New Hampshire, but I don't think we've implemented to the fullest.
Well, we did a whole really exciting program a couple weeks ago, Governor Sununu, on this idea of school choice. And somebody made the point that, you know, school choice can mean within the walls of the traditional public school. I've got a middle schooler who would love to test out of, you know, a class he already knows most of the material and move on to do something else. But somebody called in and during that program and said, you know, all this idea of school choice within the traditional public schools, innovation, excitement. This person said, look, they can't do that right now because of requirements, because of funding. And this person said they will be less likely to do so if you, Governor Sununu, keep siphoning off money for charter schools that could go towards innovation in the existing public school
Again,
system. Why create a whole new system? Why not just focus on, you know, bettering that?
Well, charter schools aren't
already
a new system, right? Charter schools have been around a while. They've had some great success. It is not us versus them. It is not an if or or. You really have to look at this in more of a global context about the opportunities we're going to provide. Let me give you a quick example. In Exeter, I'm in the Exeter School District, we have SST, Seacoast School of Technology. It's a career school. It's great. Some of the students from the local high school can come over and take these classes in everything from nursing to agriculture to computer programming, all this great stuff. Right now, the freshmen, I think, can take one or two classes there. Right, the sophomores one or two. Why aren't we opening that to our middle school, to more classes, to the freshmen, to the sophomores, giving them more flexibility to design that career path? To you know what the benefit is? It's what you brought up earlier. It's making sure that at 18 years old, they're not just graduating, but they're graduating with workforce ready skills in a career path that they've designed for themselves. That's the future of education.
We got a lot of comments on social media from our listeners, Governor Sununu, about Frank Edelblue as education commissioner. Lots of commentary about his lack of experience in the public school system. One person says, we require our teachers to be fully qualified. Why did you nominate someone with no experience as commissioner of education? And another person said, why is it okay to appoint a commissioner of education who has no qualifications for the job while holding teachers to the highest standards? That's just a sampling. We've got a lot of commentary
on
this.
Easy to just come out and say, he has no qualifications. You bring Frank Edelblue in, he knows more about how our education system runs than just about anybody else in the state. He really does. And I've sat down with him time and time again. Remember, we were political opponents, right? This isn't
friendly political opponents.
Friendly political. Well, we all, you know, I always try to keep things positive. I'm all about rainbows and unicorns. Right? No, look, Frank can sit down and he understands the pushes and pulls and dynamics of our education system like very, very few in the state do. And he said to me, he said, look, we don't need to blow up the education system here. We need to unleash its potential. And he's the one that's come up with a lot of these innovative ideas of really allowing kids to have more choice within the public schools to drive their own solutions, to drive their own pathways. I think it's great. I think he's going to be a tremendous commissioner. And again, it's all about finding a commissioner that really has the experience for the 21st century. If you want a commissioner that is just a school teacher that's going to run things, like it's 1970, there's lots of them out there. That's not the way I want to go. That's not the way the state should be going. So I think Frank's going to do a great job as commissioner.
Well, and by the way, we got a compliment for you on Twitter from River regarding the mental health program. River says, $3 million can do a lot when it's used correctly. Glad to see these steps are being taken. So, River, thank you for that comment. And let's go to Mindy in Rye. Hi, Mindy. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Governor Sununu. This is Representative Mindy Mesmer from Rye in Newcastle. And I wanted to say that I was very encouraged by your comments on Thursday during your budget address regarding drinking water and protection of our most vulnerable, our children. And as you might know, I have 4 proposed bills in play right now, 2 or more regional to the Seacoast area, which I think you're familiar with. One has to do with continuing the important work of the task force to investigate the only pediatric cancer cluster identified in the state of New Hampshire historically, and the other two are more statewide focused, having to do with coming up with a method to be more protective, to develop criteria for emerging contaminants that are more protective of our youth and our young children. I wondered if you could expand a little bit on your comments regarding your approach to drinking water protection.
Yeah, Mindy, thank you so much. This is a very scary issue for folks.
It's huge. I mean, and the example I give is there is no better faith in public service than every time we turn on our faucets at home, right? We're really trusting that the local, state, and state governments have done their job to make sure the water coming out of that faucet is clean and it's safe for us and our kids. We've seen what happened, you know, recently in Detroit. We've seen what's happened in other parts of the country. We can't let that happen here. I was an environmental engineer for 10 years, and this was my specialty, cleaning up chlorinated groundwater sites, contaminated chlorinated groundwater sites. And that's what we have in the state. We have multiple sites here right now. We have a $300 million fund that has been protected by Senator Morse for a few years. What I'd like to do, and Mindy's done a great job on the Seacoast, we have a few different groups out there that are really trying to address this issue. I think we need to take a statewide approach. I've asked Senator Morse to lead the efforts and not just put $1 million or $2 million out, but really unleash the power of this $300 million fund and start addressing this issue, not tomorrow, not with more studies and blue ribbon commissions, today. And start unleashing this money today to look at how we address our public water systems, address the contaminated wells that we have, and really put significant dollars out there so that a slight problem of today doesn't become a crisis of tomorrow.
Well, we've got lots of comments from listeners, again, that I can't go through. I just want to thank everybody, by the way. But a couple people did say, look, given the drinking water crisis that we have here in New Hampshire, I'm a little worried about the anti-regulatory rhetoric that's coming from the State House and the White House, that in some instances, regulations keep people safe from cancer.
No, there's no doubt about that. Look, I'm an environmental engineer. I spent my career making sure that people were drinking safe drinking water. I mean, that's what the foundation of what I did out of MIT was and what I did in the private sector for many, many years. It's of utmost concern. When we talk about the regulatory burdens, we're talking about the burdens that businesses face and issues like that, not so much with the drinking water issues that we have. We have to understand what these PFOAs are and what, you know, when I was an engineer just a mere 10 years ago, we couldn't even detect the levels that we're detecting now, right? So when we would get, for example, one part per billion, that's about 1,000 times more than what we can detect now at one part per trillion. So one part per billion, it wasn't an issue. But now that we have better technology, we know what's in there, we understand that, you know what, at a few hundred parts per trillion, we may have issues. So we're constantly looking to making sure we're being smart, we're understanding what the risks are, and it's still a bit unknown with these new chemicals that we're looking at. So we have to take very careful precautions. When we talk about breaking down regulations, that's more on the business sector of things. We're going to be very vigilant about making sure that we're protecting drinking water. We're going to unleash some funds and get people the services they need.
Well, Governor Sununu, we should have booked you for 2 hours.
Anytime.
Because we have so much more to go through. I really want to thank all our listeners who jumped in with their questions, sent them in advance. The conversation continues on Facebook, so go on over to our Facebook page if you want to keep this conversation going. And Governor Sununu promised me before we went on the air that he would come back anytime.
Anytime.
So, Governor Sununu, real quick, I've been told that you like to play video games with your kids.
Every once in a while, I will partake.
Admit,
I'm not very good, but
my boys play a fair bit of video games. What's your favorite?
My favorite, boy, you know, I play a lot. We play these little games on my phone. Smashy Road. My kids are all into this weird game called Smashy Road. So, you know, I play whatever they play, to be honest. Look, on days like this, we allow screen time on the weekends. But on days like this, we say, get on out there, enjoy the weather, go out and play.
All right. Governor Sununu, we'll see you soon.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.